Welcome. I'm glad you all came out here to listen to my good friend Gordon Henry. I think Gordon Henry owes his writing ability to his parents. And his voice, this ability to speak out about issues concerning Native American populations and in such an imaginative way to his parents. Our parents, as a young Indian people, I guess we're getting a little older now, but many of our parents and our grandparents really didn't have an opportunity to stand in front of people and present ideas and have people actually listen to them. And they struggled very hard to provide for families, and not just their own families, but many other people that are friends of their families. And they are able to give us, and Gordon particularly, the ability to speak out and to be heard. And I really feel that is an appropriate place for us to begin. Also, I think in his book, The Light People, we get a very clear sense of what an Indian reservation is all about. And I think if you can imagine this place as a reservation and the walls creating a boundary that encloses us, you can understand that an Indian reservation is really a community which contains not only our lives but our stories that we have to tell to one another. In the stories of our families. And like this room, the barriers force order, creates a place for people to meet, to interact, and to sit, and to listen, and to learn. And a reservation often, for me and for Gordon in his book here, is an imaginative place that at times contains the misery of dramatic transitions and the joy of mysterious transformations. And I believe Gordon writes from a sense of community. He writes for the community. His words are not just pieces of his own persona, but pieces of the reservation community in motion, changing images of familiar and tangible objects moving through time and space, fashioned and captured for a moment and observed like a jeweler examining a precious stone. Therefore, Gordon Henry's stories are more like gifts shared with members of his own family, rather than possessions. Here's Gordon.
Before I begin, I'd just like to give thanks to Peter Berg and Jane Arnold, the MSU Library, and Michael Steinberg, and those whoever did the flyer for this and distributed all those flyers around. Also, my colleagues in the English department for their support, Chair Patrick O'Donnell, and my friend Steve Rackman and Jim McClintock for their support over the years. And especially to my brothers Patrick LeBeau and Miko Slattery, and my mentor for many years here before I graduated from MSU, George Cornell. But I would like to dedicate this reading to my father for the time he's put in and to help him in his suffering he's going through at this time. And I have to go back before I can go forward. I'm going to read a few older pieces and then work on some things that are currently in the hopper. So the first piece I ever had published is this piece called Sleeping in Rain. It was published in the Earth Power Coming, an anthology that was supposed to at one time have been considered experimental American Indian prose. And since they didn't get enough experimental pieces, they thought mine would fit in somewhere. It's called Sleeping in Rain. Wake chants circle overhead, like black crows watching her will stumble through weak moments. Like when she heard the carriage outside and went to the window with his name on her lips. Or when she looked over in the corner and saw him sleeping, with his mouth open in the blue chair, next to the wood stove. She saw them, dissembled reflections on the insides of her black glasses. Moments passed, etched and the lines of age in the deep brown skin of her face. She's somewhere past 90 now, bent over, hollow-boned, eyes almost filled. She lives in a room, a taken-care of world. Clean sheets, clean blankets, wall-to-wall carpeting, a nightstand, and a roommate who, between good morning and good night, wanders away to card games in other rooms. Most of her day is spent in the chair at the foot of the bed. Every now and then she leaves and takes a walk down one of the many hallways of the complex. Every now and then she goes to the window and looks out. 2. Motion falls apart in silence, tumbling as wind turns, choreographed snow through tangents of streetlights. I am alone, to be picked up at the St. Paul bus terminal. I lost it, dropped out. Good, it's not what I wanted. What is a quasar? The tissue of dreams? No, there are no secrets. There is nothing hard about astronomy, sociology, calculus, or Minnesota winters. Those are just reasons I used to leave. To go where? To watch my hands become shadows over assembly lines? A voice clicks on in the darkness. We are now in St. Paul and will be arriving at the St. Paul terminal. Let me guess, in 5 minutes. In 10 minutes, the driver says. 3. My uncle's eyes have long since fallen from the grasp of stars. Now they are like the back ends of factories, vague indications of what goes on beneath the tracks of comb in his thick black hair. He was waiting when I arrived, waiting, entranced in existence, a series of hypnotic silences between words that had to be spoken, silences leading me to a beat-up car in a dark parking lot. I am too far away from him, too far away to be leaving for something further. I don't believe he doesn't like me. No, that's not what I'm getting at. It's something I saw when his shadow exploded into a face as he bent down over the steering wheel to light his cigarette. 4. The cold white moon over houses too close together. Front windows where shadows pass in front of blue lights of televisions. I am one of them now. A sound on wood stairs. There is a sanctuary of dreams waiting for my footsteps to fade. 5. The old woman dreams she is up north on the reservation. It is autumn, pine smoke hanging over the tops of houses, leaves sleepwalking in gray wind, skeletal trees scratching gray sky. She is in the old black shack at home, stirring stew in the kitchen. The wood stove snaps in the next room. Out the window, he lifts the axe. He is young. She watches as it splits a log on the tree stump. He turns away and starts toward the house. He is old. He takes out his pipe and presses down tobacco. She goes to the door to meet him. She opens the door. She tries to touch him. He passes through her, like a cold shiver, and walks into the photograph on the wall. 6. The mind bends over in the light through a window, down and across the body of Jesus Christ as he stumbles through the sixth station of the cross. It comes to me sometimes when I close my eyes. September sun in the old church. Smoke of sweetgrass and stained glass light. Red, blue, and yellow light. Prisms of thought behind every eye. Anishinaabeg prayers stumbling through my ears. Old Ojibwe chants fading away in the walk to the cemetery. I look at the hole in the ground. I look at the casket beside it. I look at the hole. I look at the casket. At the hole. At the casket. The clock glows red then across the room, a digital 2:37. My cousin lies in darkness, another figure covered up in sleep. 7. Dust swims in sunlight of an open door as dreams evaporate in the face of a clock. 8. Get up, I said, it's raining, and you lying there. Get up, old man, I said. It's my uncle talking this time. He found the old man where he lay in the rain. He had fallen asleep and fallen down from his seat on an old bench I tried to set on fire when I was 11. The next week, they buried him in the coolness of autumn coming. Weeks after, the old woman thought she heard his carriage outside the window of her new room in the city. 9. Cities of snow melt, blurred and liquid between wiper blades. We are waiting for the light to change. My uncle is driving. The old woman is waiting. Not really for us, but waiting. I will see her this morning. This afternoon I will be gone. Another bus. Home. The light changes in the corner of my eye, turning away. 10. The room never moves for her. It is not like snow falling, like leaves falling, like stones through water. It is a window, a bed, and a chair. 11. As the old woman touches me, it is like air holding smoke. I am something else. Vestiges of prayer gathered in the hollow church, another kind of reflection, a reflection on the outsides of her black glasses, a reflection that cries when eyes leave it. As the old woman touches me, it is like air holding smoke. I am something else. Fleet anguish like flying shadows, a moment vanishing, a moment taken as I am being. As the old woman touches me, it is like air holding smoke. It spins it. It grasps it. It shapes it in a wish. After that, there is a mist too fine to see. Two passages from The Light People, one not quite as serious. As Patrick said, a lot of the stories come out of stories that were told to me, and this is one of them. My uncle was asked to bury an old man's leg once, and so I wrote this story about this leg in The Light People, and it's really the only plot in the novel, but in any case, this is how it starts. This is Ojawa's uncle's story, and it's got a little bit of prefatory material on stones. This stone has been passed down in our family for a long time. I'm showing it to you now because your grandfather just gave it to me to keep. When you are older, then, you can carry the stone for your generation. Your grandfather claims the stone has gifts. Some stones carry earth histories, stories, songs, prayers. So their stone faces hold memories of the existences of other eras. Other beings of the earth, air, fire, and water live on, embedded in shapes, in esoteric formations of strata and substrata, in scopic design and microscopic elementals we can only imagine in our limited view of the exterior stone. Beyond the life inside, the stone was used to kill. The first great weapons relied on the stone to kill. So some stones transport memories of death. This is why I believe Chimucumán uses stones to hold his name while his body rides the earth in death. As you see, the stone in my hand has two sides painted on it. Each side tells its story. A person can use this stone to remember or turn it over and use it as a weapon. Remembering with the stone will keep you safe in creation, since remembrance opens you up to forms of creation. Thus your safety will reside in your willingness to understand the story of the stone and to use the story in the stone as we remember the stories of our family and our people. Now, as I hold this stone, I feel a particular pride in our people. And at this moment, this stone tells me we can't be killed. We can be hurt. We can be changed. We can be consumed by the desires and passions of ourselves and other people, and we can be buried. But as a people, we can't be killed. I know. Because when I was growing up in the old village, there was a family across the road from us in one of those shacks of wood and tar paper. The head of the family was an old man named Moses Forebears. He lived in that house with his wife and four children. One winter, when I was 16, one of his sons came pounding on the door early in the morning. Both my father and mother were out at the time. Father, I think, had gone to trade some skins for food at a nearby town. Mother was visiting around the village. When I went to the door, Forebear's son said, "Get your father. My father needs your help." "He's gone," I said. "There's no one else home." "You come then," he said. We crossed the road as an icy wind rose up out of the north and west, turning the village white in twisted mists. Inside the shack, the two younger children huddled under blankets near the wood stove, while the two oldest girls and old woman Forebears attended to the old man, who lay stretched out on the sofa. They applied medicine, ground roots and tobacco. They dipped cloths in steaming water. The lower part of his leg was gone. The leg was a shortened stump, wrapped in cloth, seeping blood. The cut-off part of the leg sat across the room in a wooden box on a wooden chair. The old woman spoke as I came into the room. "He drank too much," she said. "Willow." She raised her head toward her oldest daughter. "Found him in that ditch where the sweetgrass grows, around the bend from the liquor store. The foot was frozen. Part of the leg, too. He had diabetes anyway. If it hadn't froze, it probably would have gone bad on him. We gave him more alcohol, and they cut it off at the clinic in Fine Day. I don't know. Maybe this will be the end of it. He told us to send for someone to bury the leg for him." At that, the old man opened his eyes for the first time since I entered the room. cut off part of the legging of my dance outfit from the outfit with the flower and vine work on the lower legging. Four Bears called between clenched teeth. Put a good moccasin on the foot and then wrap that whole thing up and bring me tobacco. Willow left the room through the doorway leading to the back of the house. The other older daughter, Esther, drifted over to the table nearby and picked up a wooden bowl from the table against the wall away from the stove. When all was done as said, the old woman brought the leg over and set it down in front of the couch where the old man was. The old man rose up to a sitting position, grimacing between words and action. He spoke in the old way, clenching tobacco in his palm. A few tears rolled out with his words, not from pain, but from loss and the sincerity of his words, which I comprehended, though I knew only a little bit of the language. When the words stopped, he opened his palm and dropped the tobacco into the box, where it fell on the leg in a thin sprinkle. Then the girls wrapped the leg in bright floral print trade cloth and nailed a lid onto the box. Four Bears gave me tobacco. Take the leg out and bury it, but go beyond the cemetery close to the big river. Just before you get to the riverbank, find a big tree near the bank. Bury the leg there. Take Sonny with you, he signaled with a lift of his head and pushed out his lips toward the boy who sat silently watching near the wood stove. When you're done, come back here, he said. The icy wind pulled the door out of my hand and slapped it violently against the house as we went outside. Sonny fought to close the door. I looked back from the road, squeezing the leg into my body with both arms, and saw the boy as a crouching shadow, trudging against the wind to follow me. We crossed the road, stopped back home, and picked out a shovel. Most of the time, the walk to the cemetery doesn't take long. Even when someone dies, the distance is a few miles at most. But the wind ate into the day and spit snow out of the winter's whistling mouth in deep obstructive drifts of cold ghosts layering a struggle to make it to the burial place, with further struggles to make it to the nearly invisible landmarks, like the one-room library shack of books donated by the churches. The bell tower that rang into our Sunday mornings and resonated in our heads as the remembered place of an old priest flying suicide. The cemetery with all the missing crosses and illegible stones. By the time we made the cemetery, Sonny looked lost. The wind sang in fear in his eyes. He was too young to go further into the cannibal intensity of that storm, so I told him to turn around and go back home. I'll bury the leg, I said, taking the shovel. It's okay, go back. Then I turned and headed toward the river. I found a tree there, just off the riverbank, an expansive birch, an old one. I set the box out and started digging. Under the fallen snow, the ground was hard ice. The shovel bit back in stinging vibrations in my hands as I struck the earth. I struck again and again, but the earth didn't give, and I felt my face and hands flying into the air in numbness. I listened to a voice inside. Old man Forebear should have known better. Go back yourself. Sonny will tell them about the cold this wind. Go back to Forebears. No, leave the leg. You can't bury this. Go now. Find a place for the leg. You'll freeze here if you don't go now. I listened to the voice and whirled around looking for a good place on the earth to leave the leg. I saw another tree, big and strong with barren branches, toward the bottom of the bank where snowed under earth met the river. I went to the tree and tried to climb up the trunk with the leg under one arm to another higher part of the tree, to a place where I could wedge the leg in and lodge it until the storm subsided. Then I thought I could come back later and bury it. So I did that and headed back. The whole world was white then. I looked for my tracks on the way back, but the storm covered everything. I had no direction. Places that were so familiar were gone, swallowed by the storm. I kept feeling for my face. I let the shovel fall from my hands, hearing the voice inside telling me which way to go. I stumbled over the crosses in the cemetery. I came to the church, imagining the warmth inside, but the big doors were closed and I couldn't get in. I called out, but the wind and the walls of the church consumed my voice, so I went on. Somehow I came out in back of the library. Again I struggled to open a door, but snow and cold and wind locked the door. There was no one inside. So I went to the side of the building and punched the window with my numb hands. I struck the window again and again until there was a space for me to get inside the building. I fell into the room, my hands bleeding from the broken glass, but even inside, the storm still whirled out. Frigid wind pounded in through the shattered window space, turning papers up on the librarian's desk. A few books fell from shelves with each new blast in the opening in the room, and the room was cold. The old wood stove sat open-mouthed in one corner, empty near the only reading table in the place. I thought of fire. I found matches on top of the stove and thought of fire again. I looked down beside the stove, but there was no wood, so I covered the whole room seeking wood. I found nothing, so I started on the books. I randomly pulled pages from fallen books that lay strewn about the room. I crumpled the paper and filled the stove bottom. When the fire gained force, I threw in whole books. In time, the stove gave off heat, and I felt my face returning. It came completely back to me when I felt the pain of deep cuts in my hands. Then I moved the librarian's desk across the room to a place beneath the broken window. I turned the reading table over on top of that to block the wind. I made a place for myself then, right near the wood stove. I went down the wall from the books nearest the wood stove to the books on shelves farthest away. I stacked up volumes of books next to me and kept feeding the stove. Some of those books burned for a long time, and a few of those long burning books together gave me time to break chairs for wood, and then I had time to sleep and read through the storm. A lot of stuff happens in between there. And my uncle was fortunately actually able to bury the leg in his story, so he didn't have to go into the library. And I don't think there were that many books in the library at that time anyway. I think the bookmobile probably had more. But what happens is, and you know, a lot of people say Native writers are always after anthropologists, but it's not true. I think in some ways we're engaging in a kind of playful dialogue, I think, with anthropologists. And so what happens in this story is a graduate student in anthropology finds the leg. And you know, don't get me wrong, I don't want to discourage anyone from going into anthropology. In fact, my daughter's paying me back, and she's thinking about it, so. But this is called The Anthro's Tale. At that time, I was a graduate student gathering information for my doctoral dissertation. After some general preliminary research, I decided to do my dissertation on the Ojibwe as a river culture, as a people who interacted with river cultures. To gather research close to the source, I went to northern Minnesota to a small village on the Yellowhead River. When I got there, I intended to do everything in the right way. I set up an Ojibwe lodge in the manner that my preliminary research suggested. I made my journey and set up camp just as the last days of winter faded into spring signs. I chose a spot across the river from Four Bears Village, yet in the general proximity of the same kind of river culture the village would experience in day-to-day life. This was the second phase of my research studies and the first phase of my field work. I had planned in the third phase, the second phase of my field work, to interview members of the Four Bears community and to work and live with them every day for a year. During that time, I hoped to gather extensive notes, photographs, taped interviews, and cultural artifacts. Those were my plans. But after about 2 weeks of living on the river in my wigwam, I made a significant discovery. As I went out one morning to catch some fish, a large piece of ice rolled over to where I had set up on the riverbank. In almost dreamlike fashion, the ice turned a bend in the river and wound its way to the relatively placid bend I fished from. As the ice came nearer, I saw something inside the ice or beneath the surface of the river. I stepped off the bank into the water and wrestled with the ice and dragged it and the box beneath it up the bank. Then I immediately returned to my wigwam where I started a fire until I could melt the ice enough to extract the wooden box. When I did, I could tell the inside of the box was frozen solid as well. Perhaps some water had seeped in and frozen the contents. Of course, the next step included opening the box. I took a hammer and file and a few other tools and pried the box open. Inside, I found the leg still dressed in almost perfect condition. Though I had no idea about the significance, the meaning of the leg, I knew that I wanted to preserve it as it was, as a unique artifact. I put the lid back on and walked with the leg from my wigwam back to the clearing at the side of a two-track where I parked my car a mile or so away from the field site. From there, I drove to a place called Strawberry's Bar where I made a phone call to the head of my dissertation committee. He told me to keep the leg frozen, to find a place where I could preserve it temporarily until more sophisticated techniques were made available to me. I hung up the phone and asked the owner of a bar, a Sean Strawberry, if he had a freezer I could use for a few hours. He said he had a freezer, but he didn't know if I could use it since it was a freezer for business purposes only. After a few more minutes of haggling, he agreed to let me use his freezer. I brought the leg in, set it in the freezer, and went to a larger nearby town 20 miles or so from the reservation to buy a cooler and some ice. Then I went back to Strawberry's, picked up the leg, and drove straight to Minneapolis, where I met Professor Skoffner at a restaurant near the university. After I showed him the leg, we went back to his office. He called the museum immediately. That evening, we brought the leg to a meeting with the curator and a few members of the museum advisory board. It was clear that everyone was ecstatic, so ecstatic that Professor Ripley opened a bottle of the finest brandy the museum had on hand to celebrate the find. After Ripley opened a second bottle, our discussion entailed questions, speculations about the significance of the leg. Professor Schaffner posited quite eloquently the importance of the discovery, and he also accurately placed the leg in the proper cultural context. A bit of debate ensued, but the debate revolved around the issue of why the leg was put in a box and not what tribe the leg was from. The moccasin, the beadwork, the legging, the area of discovery clearly denoted the tribal identity of the leg. Everyone was in agreement on that. Professor Ripley of the museum suggested that the leg was an emblem of warfare, that the person who had lost the leg was a victim of torture, and that the torturers probably cut off human parts limb by limb and floated them down the river as a reminder to enemies. Though I was just a graduate student, I pointed out the absence of logic in such a view with questions such as, how could the torturers be sure that the enemy would find the leg? And if that was the purpose of the torturers, wouldn't they make a little canoe or raft for the leg to make sure the leg floated far enough and became conspicuous enough to catch the eye of the enemy instead of enclosing the leg in a box? I also asked whether the torturer would let one good moccasin, one excellent moccasin, go down a river when the moccasin was still functional as part of a pair the torturer could have for himself or at least give to a friend. Ripley hotly countered both of my arguments, first by saying a leg in an open canoe or on a raft would be fair game for carrion feeders. And if there were no moccasin to identify the leg, how would the enemy's family know enough to mourn or fear the death of a loved one? The moccasin, he said, served as a form of identification. Professor Schaffner ended that line of speculation by citing all the anthropological evidence his head could muster and saying, no, it's a known fact the Ojibwe and most of their enemies tortured with fire. Besides, the box and the wood of the box point to a post-war time period. Then Schaffner introduced his theory of the leg as part of a ritual to test the manhood of warrior initiates. Ripley jumped on Schaffner's speculation with both feet from a high and lofty perch. What? Cut off a man's leg to test his worthiness as a warrior? I sheepishly intercalated in that rare and brief intellectual space a theory of woodland horses and artificial birch bark legs held together by sinew and spruce pitch. But Schaffner knew I was patronizing him, and he turned the argument in another direction. Perhaps, he said, this treatment of the leg involves a ritual for getting rid of diseases in the community, a dream ritual in which the leg takes the diseases into the purifying waters of the river. No, Ripley Preston, the leg is given to the river to ensure good fishing. The argument continued this way for a good while before we all realized the leg and the reason it was in the box could not be explained by any expert in our small circle. Still, we understood the value of the leg, and in a few days, the museum offered to buy the leg from me for $1,000. Though I suspected the price might be low, I assented with the understanding that I would be given full credit for the discovery of the leg in all museum literature for time immemorial. Ironically, even though I tried to change the focus of my dissertation to deal with the origins and purpose of the leg, I never found any primary or secondary research to solve the cultural enigma of the lost leg. And I did my dissertation on another subject, on another tribe altogether. One other very short piece I just wanted to share with you. I'm working on two things at the same time. Well, actually more than that, but I mean, as far as writing goes. And one of the things that I'm trying to do is this character, Dr. Gawin, that I mentioned, is working on a book called Art Not History Not Art, Framing the Lies Between the Lines. And these are the parables and aphorisms of Dr. Gawin. And he's got a couple good ideas here I'd like to share with you. First, he prefaces this by saying, the number of dream catchers hanging from rearview mirrors has risen in direct proportion to the number of people who have gambled at Indian casinos. And this is a little bit about the craft of making dream catchers. Yellowhead wasn't easy to teach. He worked by crisis, took pride in his poverty, and lived in disaster. He shot his toes off once, overdosed on formaldehyde fumes as he was trying to taxidermy a robin. He kept embalmed collections of animals and animal parts for storytelling. He'd pull them out of a leather bag on storytelling days when he was invited to local schools. Kindergartners gathered in circles around him, enthralled as he drew rabbit, eagle wings, or a coyote jaw out of his beaded bag, and spoke the story with a part of the subject in hand. He had only recently learned the story of Robin, something about the breast or spring, he said, and he attributed his overdose to forgetting to get permission from the one he heard the story from. But that is not the story. He gave up story for craft. There are more buyers than listeners, he said, and people can't put stories on walls. Where he learned to make mandolas, I don't know. Who taught him the art of cedar arrows, I can't say. But he asked me to teach him about dream catchers. So I led him into red willow stands at creek edges, not far into swamps. We made circles and tobacco mix sometimes, circles most of the time. We worked in sacred numbers, multiples of four, patterns of seven. I showed him patterns inside the hoops, offered my visions of feathers hanging from the frame and cowrie shells hanging from the sinew, circling back into that empty dream center where I hung tobacco wrapped in red cloth. He added his own touches after a while, black stone bears with holes through their backs, cedar sprigs, stone birds. He skinned frames and alternated skin frames with unskinned, red, white, red, white, red, white, red, white, red, white, red, white, red, a sequence of 13, he said, the number of poles for the Thirsty Dance arbor. Good, I said, now you're thinking. Then I didn't see Yellowhead for a long time, not until I was scanning the vendors at the Cadillac powwow. Two summers ago, he had a stand there, selling his crafts, the woolly mandolas, of course, the skins of roadkill, I imagined, feathers and dream catchers. But something was off there. The frames were bent on some. Some were shaped like big tears, and the sinew ran crazy in some, in uneven patterns inside the hoops. He was busy with people, so we didn't talk much, just enough for me to know he was way into his craft. Then I lost him again. Actually forgot about him. Until I was watching the Discovery Channel one night. It was a special on spiders, on how they reacted to caffeine, THC, and other abused medicines. The scientists who were studying the spiders commented on how the spider webs came out different when they were under the influence of certain chemicals. Just before I switched the channel, I saw a confused web without symmetry, a design charged by dosages and reaction to dosages. As I flipped the station over, in that gray space between stations, I knew how Yellowhead had made the dream catchers he was selling at Cadillac. I also knew that that didn't mean his dream catchers wouldn't work. And the last thing, of very much a story in progress, I'll just give you a very short, I know it's getting late, and what I'm trying to do here. It's from the same book, Art Not History, Not Art. According to the 1999 Farmer's Almanac, people pay $300 to freeze dog semen so that they can have the offspring from their own best friends. And this is called the Minogijic per capita blood quantum enrollment futures business. I should have known the blood quantum sperm bank wouldn't work. True as forecast, donations were no problem. We had over 60 men who could contribute to the futures. 16 of them full blood, and the rest at least one half Minogijic skin. And the budget projections pointed to nothing but profit. I outlined the plan to Tribal Chairman Two Birds after a round of golf at the tribally owned golf course. I had hoped to speak to him as we were playing, but he was slicing and I was hooking. And there was a big wind blowing our shots like spring seeds out of bounds into woods and water. So we saw each other only on tees and greens. There was no chance then to speak to him until we were walking toward the clubhouse. I took the proposal out of my golf bag and handed it to him. He looked at it. A sperm bank futures business? Yes, I said. Figure it out. We have 564 enrolled members, a casino with monthly earnings of $25 million, and per capita payout of $30,000 per month. That's $360,000 per year per Minogijic skin. I know all, he said. I know all this. What's the point? It has to do with lifetime potential earnings. We sell semen based on that potential. You can't do that, he said. Bullshit, I countered. People do it with racehorses, and there are banks with Nobel Prize winner sperm. Is it legal? We have sovereignty, I said. untested and unlegislated in this area. He stopped, pulled out a Marlboro, lit it and smoked. I could see I was going to have to push him further. "You better quit that," I said. "It's not good for the sperm count. And as a full blood, your offspring have earnings potential for 2 generations. I could see him thinking, so I pressed on. "Imagine a big casino." "We got that," he said. "Okay, but imagine the casino is filled with hundreds of slot machines. And imagine that each slot machine has a name." "They do have names," he said. "No, imagine that each machine has an individual name for each one of our people. Then go one step further. Imagine that slot machine with your name is you. Are you going to let someone play you for free? Especially when you know that they have a chance to win thousands of dollars by playing you." "I see what you're saying," he said, "but we're not machines." "That's right," I said. "We're more valuable, and the people who will play us have better odds." I knew I had two birds then, and he confirmed that when he called me later and told me he liked my plan. It was simple. It followed the numbers. That's been one of the hardest things for me. When I was writing poetry, it was a lot easier for me. But now that I have a family, I have certain ceremonial commitments, I've sort of had to put writing in a place that I really didn't want to. It used to be first on the list. And now I've kind of got to, you know, balance it out in a way. And so that's been one of the most difficult things in the past few years. And it didn't get any better with publication. In fact, it got worse. Because what happens when you publish, at least what happened to me, is that after you publish something, a lot of other people want you to write their stories for them. And so I've had so many people come to me and say, "I have this great story, will you write it for me? Or, you know, if you can't do that, give me the name of a literary agent or something." And it's very hard because, you know, you don't want to discourage people. But there's that, and there's a lot of other things that come into play in your life that you have to balance out. And so I think it is good if you can practice. But I also think reading is probably the best practice. You gotta keep reading. Pay attention to language. Well, I don't know if he's here or not, but I was going to read a poem for one of my colleagues, his son, Thomas, this joyful little kid that was born not long ago. It's called Dotem Dream Song, and then you can call it a night unless you have something else in mind. This is for my little buddy Tom Rackman. "Old man, I will guide your silver canoe to the center of the water where the loon father carries children on his back. If I am quiet, I will arrive as a call from another shore to draw close enough to see the fantastic eyes seeing me drifting alone." So, Chimigwech, appreciate your time.